bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.
It's time for the big show from the British Tech Network. Hey, everybody. My name is Eric Lanigan. I'm filling in for Ewan, who's away on business. But we've got a lot of the regulars here, starting with James Hart. Hey, James.
Good evening, Eric. Good evening, listener. How are you?
I'm good. And we've got Sarah Jane is here also.
Oh, James. I thought I was going to get to say that. Hello, listener.
And we've got Joe DeMax here. He's also doing the switching over there on, what do you got, Wirecast going?
It would have been a Tricast, but yes, now it's Wirecast.
Well, that's cool. So, just before we started here, we were talking about, are we going to be making another VHS backup and the magnetic tapes? And then I realized that I just saw an article on a science magazine saying that cassette tapes may be making a huge comeback. They've had, like, big advances now in what you can store. They said it's a cassette tape. I don't know if that's actually what they're talking about for the real world use, but they're saying 35 terabytes of data on a single cassette cartridge that measures only 10 centimeters by 2 centimeters. They're saying that this would be used for, it's already being planned to be used at the Square Kilometer Array, the world's largest radio telescope where thousands of antennas will be collecting, I guess, terabytes of data per day. And then in order to access that, they're going to have sort of a robotic arm in a system that goes and retrieves the tape, puts it in, and spools it up to the proper location because there's just going to be so much more data than they can handle. What do you guys think of this?
We use those at work with the robotic arms because we've got so much stuff. They're actually in use now. In fact, I was talking to one of my colleagues earlier on today who was having problems upgrading the firmware on the robot.
So it's not a Nintendo Rob, is it?
No. This is a robot that changes the tapes on the tape machine.
It's one of those things you really don't want to change the firmware for because it's got mechanical moving parts and could eat your family if you're not careful. I've just got this brand new version of the firmware. It can make toast too.
Now, are they using it at your place for backup, or is it for the actual daily data that's accumulated?
No. It's actually for backup. It's the idea is so that you can do, you know, terabytes worth of backups at night, and you know when one tape finishes, that there's an automated way of actually, handling the changing of the tape.
Because that's what's interesting here is that they're saying it's going to be used for the actual daily accumulated data that has to be. You know, it's one of those. I think SETI at home was this kind of thing, as a radio telescopes just have huge amounts of data that have to be crunched through, and they found that using spinning hard drives in the typical data center style would consume 200 times more power than a tape library of similar size.
You know, I was just thinking about it. It's genius, really, because if you consider you can get what 10 megaseconds down a decent quality telephone line, you can get 10 megaseconds down. In 90 minutes, you can get a hell of a lot of data on a cassette using the same encoding algorithms. And it's just audio, isn't it, effectively? Very clever.
Yep, absolutely.
Of course, you get a read error halfway through. It'd be like your old Commodore 64 game. Damn!
I love that both of you guys have cassette tapes right within arm's reach.
This one's not even being used, just in case I want to record the chart show.
I've got one of the old DAT tapes as well. This is actually one of the. It's not one of the, even DDS 2, 3, or 4. This is one of the original DDS tapes.
What year is from that?
I think they were mid-90s, but I've got a ton of them floating around from backups from stuff.
This one is actually a real DAT tape with. It's got a DLT radio show from 1996 on it. I've got no idea why I've got this.
Oh, you're using it for audio.
DDS and DAT, not DLT tapes, DAT tapes, were very similar, except one was formatted for data, one was formatted for audio. It was the definitive way to store audio back in the day.
Yeah, it was like, it was CD quality on a tape, right?
Exactly.
One of the things I was surprised that never took off are these things.
Is it going to be mini disc?
Yeah.
Hey, mini disc. I know what you mean. I used to look at those. I wanted one of those when I was a kid, but it was just too expensive. My parents always said no. But I also didn't really have a big reason to have one. I just thought they were cool. And then MP3s came along and then totally destroyed them. But there was a time when you could make your own mixtapes and your own copies from CDs. And it would be, look at that, you both got mini discs. And it would be perfect CD quality, I think. I don't even think it applied any
glossy compression. They are digital quality.
It was the format that Minidisc used was something called A-Track. It was invented by Sony. Of course, Sony and Philips invented the cassette. Sony and Philips invented the CD. But Sony came up, and they've done this crazy thing with media, even in the days of the PSP with their tiny little data card things.
UMD,
UMD. But the Minidisc was compressed almost as bad as cassette, but not quite as much hiss. So actually, the recording quality on a mini disc is pretty damn ropey. But the medium itself is fantastically resilient. And one of the brilliant things about the old Sony mini disc players is it was ideal if you wanted to do spot effects in the theatre, because you couldn't do this on a CD, on a domestic CD player. You press the play button, and it would play once and stop and get to the next track. And you just press play, and it would play the next one. And so it would be perfect for playing spot effects in the theatre. But of course, you've got computers to do that now.
This is
if someone knocks on the door, you want to play the sound effect of someone knocking on the door. You just press the play button.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is exactly what these were used for. I used to do sound in a theatre for amateur dramatics, and this is exactly what we used for this. This is why I've got a load of them. And these are only about 3 or 4 years old.
Interesting. Yeah, and then for a while there, before the solid-state recorders became affordable, there was a big sort of community of mini-disc recorders that were, like, you know, smaller than a Walkman. And this is just, you know, like 2002, I think this was still a big thing. And it was like for a while there was the best recorders. Well, anyway, okay, we've looked at the past. We have looked at the future of magnetic storage. Why don't we take a look at the present? We have a number of announcements this week from Apple, and I'm curious to get your opinion on what the Android and the Surface competition, the Microsoft Windows 8 Surface tablet, is also getting reviewed. What do you guys think? Do you think the iPad is as far in the lead as Phil Schiller and Tim Cook were up there on stage talking about, or do you think that they were overhyping? Sarah, we don't want to start. I know you're an Android fan.
I mean, I think certainly from what I've seen about what Steve Ballmer was actually saying, and you're calling it epic and stuff, I think is a slightly being dramatic, considering that they are somewhat behind the fold. And Windows 8, okay, yeah, revolutionary on the desktop, but not exactly revolutionary in terms of the way they're going, which is pitching it at the tablet market as much as it is about any other platform, including Windows 8. So, you know, I think it was a bit overhyped. But I've seen a couple of reviews of the Surface, and you know, I actually thought, yeah, okay, that's actually quite good. Funnily enough, I was actually sitting down with one of my colleagues running Windows 8 in a VM on a desktop PC, and it took us ages to find out how to shut the thing down. So,
I saw that. Yeah,
they hit
the shutdown button.
Yeah, no, this is on a desktop PC with no touchscreen capability at all. And we were thinking, well, you know, how on earth are we going to roll this out to users if even we can't find it? Yeah, I mean, James, it'd be great when everyone's using touchscreens and stuff like that. Fantastic, but for a desktop PC, just forget it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm seeing is the.
Are people ready to learn something? Windows 8 is something that needs to be learned, just like OS 10 is something that, if you were, for example, to completely wipe out all your Windows PCs and install Macs in every desk in your office, people would need to learn it. And Windows 8 is almost at that level, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that level of difference that, you know, it's a headache for corporates to consider rolling out.
Except for the fact that if you give someone an iPhone, they'll almost be learning that kind of iOS operation. If people take up the Surface, which I can't see happening, to be honest, whatever Microsoft can do, they don't have the sales channels, they don't have the hype to be able to throw Surface at people, unless they can sell them for ridiculously small amounts of money, which they're not going to do. Unless people can get acquainted with them at home, that's when they can take it on at work.
Yeah, I think we're past the point where we can have two separate operating systems that people use a totally different system for home and for work. You know, we're seeing enough differentiation between interfaces that people are going to want a single method of working. I know Microsoft says that's going to be this Metro interface. That's why we have it on the laptops, the desktops, the Xbox, the phones, and the tablets now. The early reviews that I'm seeing are saying that about the ARM-based version of the Surface tablet, as opposed to the, I guess they're calling it the Pro that has the Intel chip that can run the back, you know, previous applications as well under Win32. The ARM-only version is being criticized for having very little software, and I think that's a big problem.
Yeah.
I want to ask everyone here, what do you think of this feature? Because let me backpedal a little bit and just tell you what my impressions were watching the Apple keynote. Phil Schiller talked about the build quality, saying how when you compare all the other tablets on the market, he was talking about Android tablets. You know, they're plastic. They weigh a lot more than this. You know, a lot of things that make this feel like a luxury product and just of a higher quality, lighter weight of a better design product. And we know from, you know, decades worth of consumer research that yields higher long-term satisfaction. You say, oh, I like this better because there's something about it you like. You like the quality of it. You like the shininess. You know, these little things matter. But also the price. It is more expensive than people were hoping. It's a lot more expensive than the Nexus 7. The iPad Mini came in at $329 US instead of, I think, $199. And who's got the $149? Is there a Kindle Fire now that there's a $149, I think? So there's that. There's the price. But then also you've got the software library. And you've got the learning curve. And this goes back to what you guys had started to say. For a new user, for a novice, you know, basically a non-geek, a non-enthusiast who doesn't really want to learn stuff for no reason. They want to learn something, and then they want to use that interface over and over again to accomplish work or whatever they wanted to do. They don't want to just play with computers and learn for learning's sake with that. So for the average user, is there any reason at all to recommend a Windows 8 tablet at this point, or even an Android tablet, when you've got so much more software on Apple's? They're saying the fastest CPU of any tablet on the market. And, of course, you've got the Apple Store, which I think for a novice user, having that free tech support and free community support just right down the road from your house, I think the buying question is answered there. So that was my impression watching the keynote. What do you guys think?
Well, Paul M. in the chat room raises a good point. Where the heck can you go and have a go on one? Apple stores, yeah, there's a few of them all over the place. You can wander to Milton Keynes, Watford, North London. Yeah, there are big towns with Apple stores in them. You can go and play on the Amazon Kindle and the Amazon Kindle Fire at your local Staples. Android tablets, bloody everywhere, you know, Car Phone Warehouse has got. Where can you play with the Surface to work out if you want one or not? Where is it going to put it?
I think maybe what Microsoft are thinking is that people will get the Windows 8 operating system on the phone, and then they'll think, oh, this is available on my PC. Oh, I want that because I'm now used to using that. And I think that's where they're really going in terms of actually getting the adoption, because I don't think as a desktop operating system, people are just going to go, you know, where do I start? But if they've actually already used it on the phone, then they might actually be willing to think, okay, well, I know how this works and know how that works, you know, and, you know, maybe spend a bit more time actually learning. And I do actually commend Microsoft for actually having this uniform, similar GUI interface across all the platforms. I think that's a really good idea, and it's the kind of thing we would expect from Microsoft.
Joe, you were going to say something?
I don't think this is going to do well. I don't think anyone normal is going to go out and upgrade Windows, because does that happen? Because I think they just buy a new computer and it ships.
Yes,
within your,
will happen. It will happen if it's cheap. They'll update it.
I think it's arguably not an upgrade for the desktop, because then you've got it's it's a hard upgrade to make the case for a desktop, really, because on the Windows desktop, the classic desktop side, you've got the ribbon interface, which I, without going into it, I think is a more confusing interface than they had with Windows 7, and is a step backwards, at least for the non-geeks, who basically knew where those buttons were anyway, back deep in the menu. They didn't need to put them out front in 1,001 buttons of all different shapes and sizes with dynamically changing locations. And then you flip over and you've got the whole tile interface, which is very poorly optimized for a big screen desktop monitor without a touch
Declan
display,
Hyde, isn't it?
So it's a hard upgrade to make the case for, and I worry about early adopters are going to probably have a very different interface. You know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years down the road, this stuff is changing so fast. They're probably going to have a whole new set of interface quirks and behaviors that you'll have to relearn. Thoughts?
No, I think you're right.
I think Sarah made a very good point that if anything, they're going to pick it up from the phone and not the Surface tablet, because the Surface tablet is right in the middle. Right. Let's have a look at the Apple iPad offering for this week. It's a little one. It fits perfectly the gap between the nice 10-inch iPad and your iPhone. And some people may actually think, oh no, the 10-inch iPad's not, is too big and it won't, you know. I think they've come in, and if you haven't got an iPad already, it will help you make the decision, potentially. I mean, it's a reasonable price point as well, especially seeing it's not that much, it's more expensive than the best iPod Touch, to invest in an iPad. Surface haven't got that point, haven't got that kind of, what's that word, that grip, that sort of, they can't start their wheels on that. So people will just see the Surface and just go, well, it's just another bloody tablet. What's so good about it? And I'm going to have to learn that, aren't I? It's not like an Android tablet where it's a bit similar to the phone you've more than likely got. The phone, if they can sell it, and they're going to hopefully do well with Nokia, you've got the HTC One. What's the HTC One called? Anyway, they've got the HTC Windows phone. No, sorry?
Oh, no, the Windows.
HTC X8 or something, isn't it? I can't remember. There's HTC are making a Windows phone. They are out in the market, and if they get demonstrated to them in the shop, or if it's a reason, more likely, if it's a reasonable price on Amazon, people are going to go, oh, that looks like a good deal, I'll buy that. But when the Surface tablet, I can't think, it's traction is the word I'm trying to look for. I can't see it getting any traction.
Now, a lot of let's look at Android for a second here, because since the iPad Mini came out, 2 days ago, there's been a lot of talk about it being too expensive. iPad Mini is similar in specifications, exact same CPU, using the A5 as opposed to the A6X in the new iPad and the A6 in the iPhone 5. So it's a slower CPU, lower resolution screen. It's more similar in those respects to the iPad 2, which I think they're trying to phase out, and this is going to be these second models. You're going to have the big one and the littler one, and I think the iPad 2 is going to eventually go away. But where it stands now, the iPad Mini at $329 is not a bargain tablet by any means. It almost is not even worth getting compared to the larger iPad. If you have certain needs and you want the Retina display, you want that speed, you want to play the latest games. So what are your thoughts? What do you think the market is going to be for this? And what Android tablets do you think compete with it? We know the Nexus 7, we know the Kindle Fire. Do you think they're competitive or not?
I think it's quite interesting, because I saw a review of the 7-inch, and one of the things that people were saying in the review was that people will go for this if they're worried about the price. And I'm thinking, well, if they're worried about price, why would they not go for a Nexus 7? Because, you know, the price is actually going to be a lot more expensive than what we were expecting it to be competitive with a Kindle Fire.
And if you've got an iPhone, why get something which is only a little bit bigger? It's a really weird one. I really don't know. And I think it's going to be telling the first 3 months of sales as to whether they sell any of them.
We may be looking at the next G4 Cube right here, really, if you think about it, because they didn't they didn't make the case. They didn't lay it out and say, they didn't show a well-produced video saying, these are the people who are going to buy this new product. You know, this is the market. We've done the research. These are the folks who want a smaller tablet. They didn't show a picture of a kindergarten classroom or an in-flight cockpit or something of the pilots using the, you know, they've all got the bigger iPads. So I wonder, who is this really going to appeal to, especially with that slower speed and lower resolution display? Joe, you have any thoughts?
No, I really don't know.
I don't like it.
You don't like it?
No, I think watching that whole keynote, it was the biggest deviation from the Jobs way since a year ago. I don't know if anyone else agrees with that, but that's how I felt watching it.
Notice that. What did you notice?
It seems so scattershot the way they went from the Macintosh to the iPad Mini, and Phil made the joke about, you know, this isn't the only time. I bet, you know, you thought you'd hear the word Mini in the keynote, and it just didn't feel like an Apple keynote in the same way that it normally would.
Is that because we're used to being surprised by what we're going to hear?
Yeah. And that's the other thing, is that it's been a long time since we've been at all surprised by anything they've done. We saw the iPhone 5 exactly weeks before it happened. We saw this months before, and it just doesn't see... There's no surprises anymore.
Yeah, this almost set the new record for the exact specifications and the exact photos leaked in advance.
Right.
I mean, they're just throwing stuff at them. They're throwing stuff at the market at the moment, Apple, as if they're trying to sort of say, right, here's all our stuff. They put a new version of the iPad out as well, haven't they? Which is just like, whoa, already?
Crazy. I have the iPad 3, and I was so shocked that they came up with a 4 so early.
Yeah, so they upgraded the CPU. It was, you know this obviously, but this for the listeners. There was the A5X.
It was the A5X in the 3, and now it's the A6X.
Right. And I think everything else was the same except for the Lightning connector.
That's probably the main motivation for them to release a new iPad, is to get that connector on it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is it, and the other driver, of course, is to get in there with the new. I mean, obviously, this could turn out to be, you know, turn into an Apple show, given that they pretty much dominated the news this week. But what they're trying to do, and it's quite interesting, is throw stuff at the wall just to sort of offset the other announcements which are being made, just to get in there quick. Not least because we've got the Christmas rush coming up, and they can make a huge amount of money if they can get people to buy their stuff.
So, yeah, so let's talk about that, because this is not the Apple show. That is coming tomorrow. So, here, I want to talk about the relationship between the other products on the market and really the Android, because what the iPad Mini is really being compared to is the Nexus 7 and the Kindle Fire HD. Those are the budget tablets. They're the hot Android tablets. They've got the unmodified Jelly Bean, at least on Nexus 7. I scanned some reviews. I saw people saying that the iPad has a lower density display in the pixel count than some of those, especially the Kindle Fire, but, you know, better color saturation and contrast and these other things that matter. Compared to the Kindle Fire, they're saying that the iPad has a much better, or rather, they're saying the Kindle Fire is too locked down, that for that price, you would be better to get a Nexus 7 if you want to install and customize it and really geek out on the tablet, as opposed to just looking at the Amazon interface and the Amazon home screen and using it as a tool for buying Amazon products.
Absolutely.
Sarah, you have thoughts on this?
No, I was just going to say that point you're making there, I couldn't agree with more. I mean, I still can't see the point of the Kindle Fire. Especially with the Nexus 7 around. I mean, it's why would you go anywhere near it? It's just, you know, I don't see the point.
Now, I want to ask Sarah this, because I know you're an Android fan. Do you have a Nexus 7 tablet, by the way? Do you have an Android tablet?
I don't personally, but I have access to one. And the idea is that I'm actually waiting until the next version comes out, because having played with one and used one, I kind of think it's a little bit early, but I definitely intend to go down that road.
So let's look at this, because a lot of people are buying these things. A lot of people who are new to tablets are looking at the Kindle Fire and they're looking at the Nexus 7. And this is according to sales data, because these have been the most popular tablets so far. The price undercutting the iPad has made that difference. But... is this a smart consumer decision? if I had someone who was coming to me and saying, I'm not a geek. I want to experience this, what this whole tablet thing is about. I don't want to spend that money for an iPad. Is it worth it to get a Nexus 7? What do you think? What would make the case?
I think it depends what you want to use it for. It really does.
Where does the Nexus 7 shine?
One of the things that slightly put me off doing it was I didn't think the keyboard was just quite there enough. For me, that's a big thing. For me, the number one thing that I'm looking for in a tablet is the ability to take notes easily when I go to a meeting and stuff like that. That is the biggest single thing I'm going to use it for. Now, I know that may not be what everybody's looking for, but I think it's just not quite there yet.
You're looking to take notes on the on-screen keyboard?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's interesting. I could never take notes like at a live meeting or a lecture or something like that. I could never type that fast on the glass.
I've actually done it on an iPad. So I know the 10-inch form is actually, it works fine.
Now, here's the price argument I wanted to make. A lot of people, when talking about cell phones, have made this argument that where the Android devices often don't match up to the iPhone is in the long-term price. Short-term, or rather, you know, the day you walk into the store, you ordered online, you may be paying $100 versus $300 for the iPhone, for one of the higher gigabyte iPhones. But over the long-term, considering the data cost, the very high data cost you'll be paying for 3G or 4G access, that smartphone will cost you roughly $2,000. And especially if you're buying a Nexus 7, actually, I don't think they have a 3G one of those, do they? But I know this iPad mini has a 3G and 4G option. So if you're comparing, especially to have a subscription to a cellular network like that, how can you really ever make the case for a cheaper tablet up front when over the long term, that extra $100 up front is going to make the difference of a faster, better, more satisfying tablet over that whole 2-year contract period and that whole $2,000 expense?
Certainly in my case, I kind of figured that out a couple of years ago, which is why I actually buy my phones off contract, because it means I get a cheaper deal on data and voice usage.
Absolutely. If you're happy to make the initial investment. Well, this is the thing, though, of course, that Apple's, well, if you consider that the Apple offering now is all Lightning connector, and that is the way they want to be able to continue stuff. In the next 2 years, you're probably not going to be able to buy any Apple accessories, which has got the 30-pin adapter on it, and therefore you've effectively got an obsolete back catalogue of stuff which people are still going to want to try and keep hold of.
So what is the lifetime
of the product that you're actually holding in your hand? I'm trying to squeeze every last month out of my Galaxy S. There's going to be a Galaxy S5 by the time I finally get rid of this thing, because I don't want to have to keep changing my phones every 2 years. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. You've got the data costs and things to go on it, but you also got to sort of think, when am I going to stop being able to use this? My son's just bought himself funnily enough, he's bought an iPod Touch 4th edition because it's been reduced in price because the 5th's come out, and he basically wants an iPod Touch which has got a camera on it, it can do stuff without being a mobile phone, so it perfectly fits him. But even that, I mean, one of the reasons is because he can't get above iOS 4 on his second generation. But even that is going to be aged out in the next little while because he's not going to be able to buy anything that hasn't got a Lightning connector associated with it. So it's kind of like you're almost tied into what you have until they tell you you can get. You know, until they tempt you with something else, or they won't support your bit of kit anymore. How many phones are still running? Eclair, quite a few of them are, aren't they?
A lot. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems Android continues to have is how to get those upgrades, especially on a non-Google branded phone.
That is yet another reason why it is good to actually buy the phone off contract, because like I did. You know, I bought this Nexus S purely because I thought, well, actually, there's no carrier stuff getting in the way of actually an OTA or, you know, even if I want to do the upgrade, I can do it myself without any issues. You know, there's just so many reasons if you can afford it. And I treat it like James was saying, you know, if you go for that option of doing that, then it does actually give you a lot more flexibility in terms of how much life you can actually get out of the phone. I've had this Nexus S for it's about 21 months now. And I was originally thinking, okay, January 2013, time to get a new phone because it's 2 years. But I'm thinking, don't need to. I'll get a tablet, probably a Nexus 7 or something like that, next generation. I can tether with it. What else do I need? The phone's fine. Does the job.
Joe, you have any last tablet thoughts before I move on to I want to talk about the Fusion Drive just briefly. Anything else, Joe?
I want a 7-inch tablet, just, you know, and I already have an iPad, so I think I'm going to get a Nexus 7 just like Sarah, because for the price, it's a great way to get into Android, you know. And it will get updates for a long time because it's a Google device.
Because it's pure Google, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, clearly the pure Google devices are the thing to get if you want to get the full Android experience and tinker and play and just see what Google has in store for you. but I want to talk briefly. Obviously, this is not the Mac show, but I think this is cool. I want to see if you guys know of what equivalent things might be in the works on the Windows side or are already in use. Apple announced the new iMacs. They're a lot thinner, at least on the edges. They've got a razor-thin edge, more like the MacBook Air now, and they kind of bulge out in the center in the back where you can't see it as much. So it's a cool new design. They are color calibrating every one of these monitors that rolls off the assembly line on an iMac. Now, I think that's awesome because that's been a big problem for home users, is having poorly calibrated, not very accurate displays when people are doing photo correction and color correcting of videos and photos and home media. That becomes important. So they're actually using 3 spectrometers to calibrate the displays before they leave the assembly line. I thought that was really cool. And they're also IPS displays. So those are some really awesome displays in there. But the Fusion Drive, they announced a new system that I think might be an Apple first. Correct me if I'm wrong. But they're combining inside of the iMac a 128 gigabyte SSD drive with up to 3 terabyte mechanical drive. And they combine them in software to be a single volume. The system sees it as a single volume. And over time, the system will determine what you access most frequently, things like the operating system files and your most frequently accessed applications and some documents, as well as any writes, any first writes to the disk happen in the SSD. And then the stuff that isn't needed gets, you know, ported over to the 3 terabyte drive. And okay. Apple claims that the speed that you get is equivalent to an SSD. I think this is really cool because go ahead.
It might be, but my first reaction when you said about the way it's actually the two are linked, I'm thinking, okay, I've got 2 points of failure rather than 1. Presumably, if one of those drive fails, then the other one's no good as well.
That probably is true, yeah.
So instead of having 1 possible point of failure, I've got 2.
I was thinking about this, though, because I saw...
The machine that we know with Apple is probably not economically repairable.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, you probably do have to take it in.
That said, though, hard disks have growing amounts of cash on them anyway. There is more cash on a hard drive now than there ever has been before. And all this does is adds to that a kind of a semi-permanent layer to that cash, which I dare say won't get the panning that an SSD on its own would. Yes, there's potential for failure, but I think there's more potential for failure in a physically moving device than a device which will eventually die because of the way that the system works. So
yeah,
I don't know. Oh. It's tricky.
The thing is, though. I mean, I like the idea of SSDs and I like the idea of spinning drives for certain, each for a different particular function. The problem I have with SSDs have a limited number of times that you can write to them, and obviously, spinning drives have a failure rate. You know, where they could go wrong within the first few months, you know, possibly, mm-hmm. you know, because they're mechanical. It's just the way it is. So you've actually introduced 2 potential problems, and effectively you've got a completely useless machine if one of them actually packs up. Okay, if it's under warranty, you can go back to Apple, but, you know, outside a year, that's still not good. If they were 2 completely separate drives, and if one went, you could actually still use the other one, I'd be a bit happier about it.
Yeah, certainly. I'd be happier if Apple let you, you know, just swap it out with your own hard drive. And that's why I'm really curious to see what they have up their sleeve with this new rumored 2013 Mac Pro. I have a feeling it's going to be very hard drive based, because I know that's how I use a Mac Pro, is to load that thing up with all the drives it can handle and use it. Yeah, I've got a striped RAID 0 and all kinds of stuff. So I have a feeling that whatever Mac Pro upgrade is going to be is going to focus on internal drives. But if I were buying a desktop today and an iMac, I would absolutely want one of these things. I saw a review that said that the reviewer posited that geeks would prefer to have two individually managed drives, like have your operating system on the SSD and then have your home folder on the drive and let you portion out each individually. And I thought, I don't really think so. I think if this really does what it claims to do, which is to intelligently move over the files you use most frequently, and I guess based on the most recent access date would then shuffle the other stuff over, I think that's really going to be the best of both worlds, not to have to manage where you store these files, but just say, just whatever, you know, pick the best one. And so basically, it's almost like having a 3 terabyte SSD drive.
In an ideal world, the way it should work is that the operating system should have intelligence built into it to know where to store a file in terms of type of media according to what it is. For instance, a paging file should never be stored on an SSD drive, because it would absolutely knacker that SSD drive in no time at all. So that you stick on a spinning drive. And the OS should actually have the intelligence to know when it's installing it, where to put this stuff, given the choice.
I'm really surprised that you'd say that, because I would think that for the swap file, the page file, the virtual memory, I would think that you'd want that to be on the fastest possible drive.
No, the whole point is it's going to, excuse my language again, knacker that drive pretty fast, because of most of the read-writes are going to be to that paging file where it's swapping out memory. So even if you've got a ton of memory in it, it's still not going to be good for that SSD drive. As I say, remember that with an SSD drive, you've actually got a limited number of read-writes that you can do to that drive. The last thing you want is it hammering it if it's actually paging memory in and out all the time.
And I would say also that the fact that a machine, an operating system, would need to page memory actually is a symptom of not having enough physical memory. So,
so you don't
want to be relying on something like an SSD drive to take the burden off your memory.
Right.
Paging needs to happen eventually, but
it depends on the type of application you're running. If you're doing a lot of video editing, I would imagine it's actually going to page in quite a lot. If you're using virtual software like I do on it, it's going to page in and out quite a lot. That's just the nature of the way it works, particularly if you're running multiple virtual machines.
Yeah, of course. I mean, isn't
I was just going to say that that being said, the whole point of writing software which is optimized for your machine is to be able to use the facilities which it is designed to have. For example, paging memory is so that you can use beyond the capabilities of the memory you've got. If you're going to be editing vast quantities of video, you probably want a massive amount of physical memory on your machine. That's a simple fact. If I throw another example, there's a difference, I think. If I'm recording video and recording movies, I want to be able to shift a load of data very quickly onto a device. I don't want to be pulling the data back off and on it again. I want to be able to read once and write once, so you get less fragmentation and a continuity of data flow. If that's an SSD card, absolutely fine. I want to do that. If it's a hard drive, a physical hard drive, fine. If it's fast enough to be able to do that, it's not the sort of thing one would need memory for. But is it processing? What would one need a huge amount of memory for, apart from virtual machines, which you would, again, if you're designing your virtual machine from the ground up, you would be making sure you had enough memory for each virtual machine without having to page. Oh no, you'd be compromising all sorts of directions if you start paging.
I don't know, maybe it just makes you
feel uncomfortable.
We're getting very geeky, aren't we?
Go on.
Well, that's the point. I'm just still baffled why you guys are saying to put the page file not on the SSD.
I would think that would just
slam performance.
I do that right now. On this MacBook Pro, it's only got 4 gigabytes of RAM, so I just leave the page file on the SSD. And I mean, sure, it's fast, but it's going to break it really quickly, and I know that.
Well,
because with physical hard drives, you're writing the same sections over and over again. The way the SSD works is every time you write a sector, you write a different sector, and you tick a little box to say I've written that. And there's only so many times you can tick the box before it stops working.
Right.
My point exactly.
I get that, but then why have an SSD if you're going to? I mean, wouldn't you say that one of the biggest
reason you have an SSD is because you can boot up bloody quickly because it gets all the stuff it needs off the hard drive. SSD is perfect for reading multiple times. It's you can get stuff off it quickly, and you can just read stuff. It's also very good for writing a few times at a ridiculously quick rate. So actually, shutting down a machine is absolutely fine as well, because you can just spill your memory onto it and you're fine. It's the little interactions, it's the sort of the quick here and there that it's really no good at. The thing that intrigues me about this Fusion Drive is anybody who's serious about owning an Apple product will have taken it out, would have taken their optical drive out and put an SSD as a boot disk, and having a separate storage device as a spinning disk. And all they're doing is just going, hey, we can make some money out of that. We'll save you the bother, but we'll put it on our own little case, and you won't be able to break it apart, but you can still have a CD-ROM if you like.
So, yeah. I mean, I have two things. Is that how is this going to work in boot camp, if anyone even cares about that?
It won't. Windows won't have a driver for it.
Right, well. But going back to what Eric said, I mean, the reason that a lot of the time, if you ever talk about doing an SSD upgrade, people will recommend you load up your system with physical RAM, you know, to take the wear and tear of virtual memory off the SSD. So, yeah, don't, because it will die.
But isn't even the most worn and torn SSD drive, with just so many page ins and page outs written to it, isn't that still going to be faster than a magnetic mechanical drive that's spinning and is fragmented and trying to jump to all these different places trying to find the data?
It will get to the point where it won't work at all if you carry on.
Eric, you're absolutely right. It's speed over lifetime. And this is exactly why I'm making the point about this hybrid drive and why it is not a good idea. Because if that SSD runs out, you know, not going to run out of space, but if its lifetime disappears, that machine is gone. It's history.
Well, yeah, but you guys remember, 128 gigabyte drive, and I don't know about you, but my page file never is bigger than about 8 gigs, and usually it's closer to about 2 gigabytes or even, you know, under a gig if I don't have a lot of stuff open.
Okay.
I'd be a lot more worried about what that drive does when you do things like capture video into iMovie, which the average customer does, or import photos into Aperture. All these early data writes are being written to the SSD. I don't know about iMovie. I don't know from what they've said, it sounds like they would have to custom write iMovie to not write to the SSD and to go straight to the mechanical drive. But that would be a big problem. If you're writing terabytes worth of data, or at least gigabytes of video files or very large chunks of data that you're just going to move around, again, that would be the least necessary to have on an SSD, a big video, and would be much more harmful than having just the page file.
This is partly the point, Eric. This is what I'm saying. You know, what most people are going to use it for, they're not necessarily going to think about, oh, I need to put this file here, in terms of paging and, you know, data and so on and so forth. And they're not going to customize. This is why I think it's so important that vendors, you know, who develop operating systems, whether it be Apple or Microsoft or whatever, that they build operating systems to actually think about intelligently where these files need to be stored to get the optimum performance, given the hardware that you can actually see that you've got in this machine. You know, and at the moment, if you install Windows, and I'm sure it's the same Windows 8, if you install Windows 8, you say, I want it on the C drive, bang, the whole lot goes on there. It doesn't even think about, you know, where it's going to put anything. There's no intelligence goes into it at all. But it needs to start thinking about, well, if I've got an SSD drive and I've got a spinning drive, yes, it makes sense to actually put the OS on it, as James says, so it can boot up faster. But the paging file, you know, I might put a small one on the SSD, but the big one, if I am going to install a, you know, video editing app or whatever on there, it needs to be on a spinning drive. And okay, it might be that little bit slower, but it's going to increase the life of that machine, particularly when you've got something where you can't actually replace it. And we know Apple are going down that route of basically, you know, when your machine fails, just chuck it in the bin.
But then I think I have to ask them, what are you going to fill that 128 gigabyte SSD with, if not the page file and if not the things that make the most speed difference? Why buy an SSD to begin with?
Applications. Operating system files.
Absolutely.
Well, okay. So it saves you what, 30 seconds in the morning when you hit the power button?
Yes.
I mean, what else besides that?
No, Safari doesn't take 50 bounces. It takes one. It's fantastic.
And it's the same with Windows or Linux. It doesn't matter what you put on there.
What's intriguing,
Hold on, though. Think about what you're saying. All Safari has to do to boot up is to load. What's the program? It's got to be like 50 to 100 megabytes. That's a quick write off of a magnetic drive. But I think the bigger thing happens when it starts opening all these page files and preparing to store virtual memory. I think you have to have the virtual memory in the SSD, or else what's the point?
No, what's your boot drive in your Mac Pro right now?
I've got four mechanical drives.
And you raid your boot drive?
The boot drive is a single Seagate 7200 RPM terabyte, I think.
You won't understand until you join the club.
Well, I've got the Air right here. I do know what an SSD is.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's the point I was going to make. Actually, SSD drives are starting to come down in price quite significantly now. There's a 128 meg for just under £60 on Amazon.
And it's not 128 megabytes.
128 gigs. Sorry, I do beg your pardon. 128 gig for just over £60. £80 a few months ago, 6 months ago, £60 now. It's getting to the point where actually your boot drive can be quite easily replaced with a reasonable amount of hard drive space, and it does make all the difference. I don't think I would build a PC now without an SSD boot drive.
Completely agree.
All right. Let's go to. I think we have time for one more big story. And
can we do the Amazon story? Can we?
That's what. I'm getting there. I'm about to say it, and it's going to be introduced here by James, who brought this to our attention, put it in the document. James, what can you tell us about this Amazon story?
Well, anybody who owns a Kindle is aware, certainly if they've been reading the news story over the years, because you've had issues with rights on books, where if a book is in the marketplace and then somebody contests that, they can remove that book from your Kindle because you no longer hold the rights to have it. This poor woman, if the story is correct, had her account closed and her Kindle wiped by Amazon, just like that, because it was connected to somebody who'd been indulging in some. Well, I don't think it was fraudulent. They said it was. Hang on a second. Directly related, which has been to an account which has been previously closed for abuse of our policies. So they've
read us the whole letter, James, because I think the wording of this letter is interesting. This is a letter that was sent to this random customer by Amazon, by an executive customer relations guy named Michael Murphy.
If it hasn't got executive, he's not important enough. My name is Michael Murphy, and I represent executive customer relations within Amazon.co.uk. So she's in Norway, but it's an Amazon.co.uk account. One of our mandates is to address the most acute account and order problems, and in this capacity, your account and orders have been brought to my attention. Possibly automatically. It goes back to our little sort of thing on YouTube the other day. We have found that your account is directly related to another which has been previously closed for abuse of our policies. As such, your Amazon.co.uk account has been closed and any open orders have been cancelled. Per our conditions of use, which in state in part, Amazon.co.uk and its affiliates reserve the right to refuse service, terminate accounts, remove or edit content, or cancel orders at their sole discretion. Please know that any attempt to open a new account will meet with the same action. And you may direct any questions to me at resolution-uk at Amazon.co.uk. Interestingly enough, I can see why this might happen. If she lived in the same flat, had a flatmate who'd nicked a load of books and installed it on their Kindle, because she has the same address as this person, she's got nothing, no leg to stand on. They can just do it like that. For no, you know, if they don't trust you, they will remove. And not only that, as you said, Eric, the worst bit is, if she was to open another account, it would be linked to that account. She'd get exactly the same message.
I love that sentence. Any attempt to open a new account will meet with the same action. And according to this lady, she's done nothing wrong. This is not, she's never defrauded Amazon. She says, I've only ever had one account. She says, I have no idea what you mean that my account is related to a abused account. And what's been their response? Is Amazon, did they come back and say, oh, we're sorry, here's all your stuff back?
Nope. They said, we regret, basically they said, well, we can't tell you what you've done wrong. Although Darren in the chat room says the policy violation that Lynn stands accused of is using a friend's UK address to buy Amazon UK English Kindle books from Norway, which, you know, is, well, I don't know whether it's part of the conditions of service or not. But the fact is, the brilliant line at the end was, We regret we have not been able to address your concerns to your satisfaction. Unfortunately, we will not be able to offer any additional insight or action on these matters. Sod off. We wish you luck in locating a retailer. This is brilliant. We wish you luck in locating a retailer better able to sort of meet your needs, and will not be able to offer any additional insight or action on these matters. Maybe it's just
God.
Good luck finding somewhere else.
Oh my God. They may as well give him the link to barnesandnoble.com. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy.
There is one really good thing about this.
What's that?
This was bound to happen sooner or later. I've started to realize that with the Amazon Kindle, that I'm in a walled garden. I've always say with Apple that I was part of the reason why I wouldn't touch him with a barge pole. I started thinking about this sort of thing. Now, for this sort of thing to come out, it's actually going to do Amazon no good, and they're actually going to turn around and look at why this happened, how it happened, and so on, which can only make things better. I feel sorry for this lady, I really do, but it actually is good for the rest of us.
I wonder if there isn't a Michael Murphy. I'm starting to think it's just a piece of software that goes by the name Michael Murphy.
Or one of those people at a call center.
We found the robot again, haven't we?
Exactly. It's a Turing test all over again. Well, it's the thing that really balks me is the fact that you've got this piece of equipment, which is ostensibly now completely useless unless you sign into it. Even if you sign into it as somebody else with the same address, you know, you are frozen out of being able to use this equipment. All your books, completely gone. That's it. Done. If you'd bought the books, or if you'd done what Simon suggested and printing out his Kindle books, yeah, nice one, had them all stacked on the shelf, they can't take them back. Maybe you've got to put them in a photocopy. Put it in a scanner and just press the next page button.
Can I ask a question on this? Is it me, or am I being particularly dense here? Or is it, if I switch the Wi-Fi off on my Kindle, how the hell can Amazon do anything to that?
They can't do anything until you want to buy another book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But they don't give any warning. I think the first thing this woman knew about it was when all her books disappeared.
Yeah,
it's not as if you could sort of. It's not like having your dodgy stash of stuff and then disconnecting it all from the internet, going nobody can get me.
Yeah,
she didn't realise she'd done something wrong until they erased it all.
They probably wiped first, asked questions later.
The point I'm making is that if I was genuinely doing what Amazon accused me of doing, the first thing I would have done after I got all those illegal books would have actually been to disconnect the damn thing anyway.
I don't think she realised it was illegal because she was using the Amazon.co.uk. I don't know. Well, maybe, for example, she wants to read English books, and the number of books in the Amazon.ne, N, whatever Norway
so,
is.
So I'm confused now. Did this woman actually violate policies?
I'm guessing so.
I mean, do we know that for sure, or could this be just a total mistake?
Well, the thing is, we will never know because they are unwilling to engage in any more discussion on the matter. Sorry, goodbye.
What does that mean? Do you get a refund for the device? You get a refund for all your books, for all your everything you've ever bought for it? Probably not. They just took your money and they gave you nothing. I mean, that's not right.
No, you can bet your bottom dollar the T's and C's say that if you, in terms of usage, say, if we deem that you violate anything, you forfeit all rights to this with no recourse or refund.
Yeah, and that's a big problem because you've got all that language. That's true in the Apple iBook store, and I mean probably every platform you can name. It always says you have a license to access this book, which we can revoke at any time with no refund.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's the modern age, my dear.
Yeah, I know.
You buy a book from your local bookseller, hopefully an independent one, because they need them all the money they can get. You, at least you've got it on your. You can sell that book on. You can sell it on Amazon in their secondhand book market, but you can't do that with a Kindle book. That's brilliant.
My latest thing is thinking about books in terms of PDF, because then I can put them on my Kindle and they're not Amazon books, but I can still read them on my Kindle. Or I actually bought a book not long ago and I've forgotten the actual format name, but it's actually Amazon Kindle format, but it's not. Or Amazon format compatible format, but it's not actually Amazon.
This is it. I mean, maybe she can use her e-reader to do those things and actually still have it as a usable device. I mean, if they completely disabled it, that would be awful.
So
but what she has done, though, is she has paid good money to buy some books in the UK probably, I mean, ignorance is no defence. It's just the fact that it was rather a nasty shock for her, and they didn't give her any, you know, it's not really, Amazon is brilliant at customer service if you buy something and it doesn't work, but if you do something against their terminal service digitally, it's the fact, I mean, that this is what, this is the whole problem with digital virtual content, stuff that you can't hold in your hands, is actually, you can only really, it brings us back to the whole YouTube thing the other week, is you can only really come down really heavily on it and make it disappear to be able to assert your digital rights on it. You can't say, can I have that back, please? Hang on a second. Copy, copy, copy. It's not like in the old days when you had two cassette recorders and your little tape-to-tape machine and you take it back to the record library. Not that we ever did that. No, you have to make it go away to be able to retain your digital rights. And I think it's either something we're going to have to get used to or we're going to have to get wise to. Oh, I like that.
Let's see. I think we might have... It restores her account. Still no explanation. I don't know if this is new or not, but the chat room just posted this. I guess we saw that. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it raises another interesting question, which is if you get a book from a source, like you get one of those EPUB books or you get... I've tried this. I went looking for books when I first got a Kindle on torrent sites, and the formatting was just really awful, which is why I quickly gave up on that idea, trying to convert, especially if you get a PDF that's not properly formatted as an ebook. It's just a nightmare. It's not worth it. If you can get the real thing for like $7.99. But... could they go into, and I don't mean just Amazon, could any company go into your device that you bought from them and scan its contents and see whether you put stuff on it that is not illegal? I mean, that is illegal, that didn't come from them, and then cut off your whole account. And you know, I don't like the idea that they got all your money and then you have a bricked device and you have no recourse.
Such is life these days, Eric. This is the future. This is and it's the present, actually. In fact, it's the recent past, but it also represents the future, is the point.
Cassette tapes store everything on
cassette. Exactly. They're the future. These are the future. And if she downloaded it all onto a cassette tape, none of this would have happened.
You know what's funny? I think those old science fiction movies from like the 80s knew more than we thought they knew. I think they were actually very prescient on these issues. When you look at those things and they got like standard definition TV monitors, CRTs, everything's a CRT display, and they got cassette tapes and they got the big bulky Walkmans. I think they knew what they were doing. They knew we're going to get to a point where we have to go back to the old style things. Things are going to be sort of on a book and you just put the cassette tape in and that's how you read your book because it's the only way that they can't get to it and remove it from you.
Exactly, they have to come around your house to take it. Yep, there we go. I think we've solved the problem of technology for the next 20 years at least.
So there you have it. The future really will look like the future of the Max Headroom and the various early science fiction things.
Before you move on, have you got anything within arm's reach which is physical media, Eric? What have you got?
I've got a couple of CDs here. Here's a disc. No,
that'll do. Oh God,
that's a proper set. No. That'll do. It's before he was born. That'll do me.
He's not even got one of these, is he?
Oh, go on.
Oh, which you got?
It's a USB stick.
Joe, switch over.
A USB stick doesn't count. Does it count as physical media?
Of course it does. These days. You can store music on it. You can store software on it. It's exactly the same as a CD.
I was just going to make the same comment as SM2N in the chat room that Eric, your background does look a little bit like Max Headroom's.
I know. If it were only moving a little bit, it would look exactly like that. All right, well, this podcast and all the podcasts on the British Tech Network are brought to you, of course, by UK2.net, the generous providers of all the bandwidth for the British Tech Network. And Ewan always, you know, thanks them profusely and is very thankful to them. And we have some deals for British Tech listeners. If you want to get free DNS for 2 years, you can sign up using the code BritishTechDNS. These are all run together, no spaces, for 20% off all your new domains, British Tech domains. For 50% off VPN for the first month, British Tech VPN is the code. For £50 off of any gigabit server on any contract, that would be British Tech Server. And for the first month of free VPS, British Tech VPS. And they've been supporting the British Tech Network for over 3 years, and we're just very thankful to them. So thank you to UK2.net. And, of course, use the links, get to them via the links on the British Tech Network website so that you and everybody gets credit. So do we have any cool things? Who'd like to go first?
I'll go first. I don't know if this is Redux. I don't know if we've done it before, but it has changed a little bit. If you get the opportunity, if you want to learn coding, Codeyear.com is a fantastic place to do it. It had been doing a sort of a weekly course on JavaScript, jQuery, CSS, and now they've moved on to Python. And so it's just amazing the opportunities. I mean, my boy's been doing it sort of, we've been bribing him with chocolate, but he's been doing it. He's been sort of filling in the exercises, and he's quite, it's quite an enjoyable thing to do. You spend half an hour just going through some exercises which have been made for you. It's not a case of bookwork. It's activities. It's something on the left, something on the right. You work it out for yourself. You click the button, it tells you you've got it right. It is very, very good indeed. And the best thing about it is it's free. So this is the opportunity to get yourself educated in a system which you could probably apply to any modern website technology. Yes, UK2 will give you the web builder application to be able to help you build your applications. But if you want to do it yourself, if you want to learn about CSS and learn about how to make your websites look like something which is better than GeoCities from 1998, Codeyear.com by Code Academy is the place to be. And this advert has been promoted by me. I didn't read any of that.
Sarah, what do you have?
I've actually got one. I'm struggling to find a web page for it. It's an Android app. Maybe I should have done this before the show, but I kind of ran out of time. It's called LT Pro. It's on Android. And there is a free version too. Now, basically what it does is it gives you loads of information about traveling around on public transport. Just give me a sec, Joe. It gives you lots of information. It's got the Transport for London journey planner on there on the pro version. Unfortunately, you have to pay for that. But the free version's actually got lots of stuff about bus times and tube times and stuff like that. I find it essential when I'm going up to old London town and stuff, when I'm coming back, how I'm going to make my connections. And it really helps me and saves me a lot of time.
Cool.
It's called LT Pro or LT Free is the free version.
Very cool. And Joe, do you happen to have anything?
Yeah. That's all I got.
What is that?
Have you seen this?
No. Oh, it's EricLanagif.com.
Yeah.
that's a real thing now?
Yeah.
That's the robot. That's the robot we were talking about earlier. It is the robot we were talking about earlier, isn't it?
There you go.
It's too bad the frame rate wasn't that good on the Skype. That's funny.
That was so fun.
For the audio listeners, if you go to EricLanagif.com, you can see me slowly rotating back and forth, creating a 3D effect, although not really. Who made that?
I think Mr. Rankin is responsible.
Well, thanks, Ewan. That's very amusing. My pick is just a quick thing because I don't really have anything, and I haven't downloaded this either. It's the latest Mac Heist at MacHeist.com. Only one day left to get all this stuff. Interesting to see what they've done this year, because I imagine that the Mac App Store has been giving them a run for their money. Kind of decreases the relevancy of these app bundles, which had just gotten started and just got popular. And then the Mac App Store came along kind of shifted the developer and customer resources to having the Mac App Store. So I suspect that's why it's cheaper than it used to be. It's $29. And the software is not as good as it used to be in the past, but there's probably some good stuff here. Here's an app that allows live disk defragmentation. Usually you have to reboot to do that on the Mac. So there might be some good stuff.
Do not do that on an SD card, whatever you do.
Yes, definitely not. Definitely not. Do not defragment your SSD drives or they will be dead in a hurry. Let's see, a couple of games. So yeah, some good stuff to check out. It looks like an HDR photo tool, online radio, Bejeweled 3, Scrivener is a popular writing application. So there you go, MacHeist.com, and that's this year's bundle. One day left. So thank you guys.
They do some very interesting ways of doing that, don't they? They sort of put these little quizzes and puzzles, and so they don't just make it a sort of buy it out of the box thing. They turn it into a kind of a game, really, don't they?
They did. They had. I think they were doing the Myst motif because, you know, Myst had a big high-profile relaunch on iOS this year with higher resolution graphics and stuff, and that old CD-ROM game Myst is now popular again. And so I guess they partnered with them to do a Myst-themed sort of a scavenger hunt. And they had like the Mac Heist Nano Missions where you could do a you could solve the puzzle and then get like a free app. I didn't do it because I looked at it like I don't have time for this and the app doesn't really interest me that much. But hey, it's a cool
idea.
Which
pretty much sums up Myst for me, actually. I can't be honest with this. Too hard.
Yeah, so all right. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thanks for joining us, even without Ewan. You can find, we'll go down the line. James, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter, or the Twitters, as I believe it's now called, SYZYGYCZY on Twitters.
And Sarah?
You can get a hold of me on the Twitters at SarahJaneUK, and I found a link for my cool thingy, by the way, which I put in the chat room and in the show notes.
Okay, cool. And Joe?
Just at JoeDemux on Twitter.
And I'm EricLanigan.com and Twitter.com/EricLanigan and EricLanigif, apparently now. ERIKLANIGAN. So thanks, everybody. And I'll be filling in for Ewan next week also, unfortunately. Sorry. But we'll be doing this again next week. So we'll see you guys next week on British Tech Big.